Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm sitting across from Bruce Whatley to talk about his extraordinary book, Reuben. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you very much.
Now, Reuben's difficult to explain on a podcast.
Right.
It's. I know that anyone who is visiting bookshops over the next few months will see it in windows and on counters, and will be compelled to pick it up because it is such a gorgeous object just by itself, without even going any further than just holding the thing itself. I think people want to have one in their home.
Oh, good.
This has been a long project, passion project of yours?
Yeah, I've been working on it for nearly 10 years, off and on. I've done a lot of books in between. But the starting point for it really came from being a bit disillusioned with what I've been doing. And I was aware of so many Australian illustrators and authors doing some incredible work, and I felt a little bit left behind, to be honest. And I felt I needed to do something different, and something that was perhaps as true to myself as I could be. So I looked for a project, and I developed the character first, Reuben, who was actually based on my daughter, my adult daughter. And I just sort of took pictures of her in clothes that I quite liked and found interesting. And then I played around with those photos to create the character. And then after that, I had the last line of the book, which was, "Once upon a time, Reuben caught a train." That's all I had.
So that's 10 years ago? I mean, over the years, you've worked with, I think, I actually wrote them down here because I wanted to get them all in. And this is just a smattering of them. I mean, we're all very aware of the work you've done with Jackie French with The Diary of Wombat, and there are 6 wombat books. I mean, yeah. I've got to ask you, do you still like wombats?
I do, actually. They're quite cute. Yeah.
But you've worked with your wife, Rosie Smith. You've worked with Gary Crew, Libby Haythorne, Philip Wynne. You've worked with the Dado at one stage. I mean, you've worked with Ando, I think, as well. Yeah. All the big names in children's publishing. In the background, you've had Reuben. What was it that drew you to particular projects? Is there a thing that draws you to a project? Is it the story? Is it the author? What is it that sort of draws you in?
I mean, sometimes it kind of makes good business sense. I mean, that's one side of it.
Yeah.
But more than that, the story has to be right. Normally, I need to read a manuscript and it gels with me instantly. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened with Diary of a Wombat. Okay? As soon as I read that script, I saw the character and it just came to me instantly. And similarly with the project I did with Ando, in that was a little bit different in that was more serious. It was about real events and I couldn't mess around with that so much. But often with authors, they will write illustration notes, for instance, and the first thing I do when I receive those is delete them, because I don't want to see them, because my job is to value add. So rather than be pushed in a particular direction, I like the freedom to just take it somewhere else. And I've been very fortunate in that the authors have been very generous and let me do that. And that way, hopefully, I can value add, and then if they look at my dummy or my roughs and stuff like that, they can change text. And so it's an organic process and we can just build on it.
So is there a lot of back and forth, or is it generally you finish the project, you send it to them and they come back, or do you give them something to begin with? So I'm going in this direction. Is this the right direction for you?
Yeah, it varies. I mean, it all goes through an editorial process anyway. Everything goes through the editor at whichever publisher, and everybody works a little bit differently. What generally works, how I normally work, is that I get sent a manuscript from the editor, and when I say yes to doing it or whatever, I will then go away and do a dummy. Like I said, I won't look at the illustrator's notes. And very often I will take a totally different tact and I'll turn somebody's story on its head. And that way I can find a different sort of humour, maybe a different visual narrative, so that the text is there but the illustrations are very different. And then that's the way you can bounce off more storylines, but you can also bounce off the humour, being that you say one thing but you show something else. So I normally then produce a dummy, which goes back to the editor, which goes back to the author, and hopefully they're happy with it. And like I said, it's a bit of an organic process, and we'll sort of work on that and change things.
Is it the author or the editor or the publisher that will say, "We've got to get Bruce onto this one"? They read the script an author's sent in, and then they go, "This is such a Bruce book." Is that the sort of process,
yeah,
or is it the author
that,
generally?
That can happen. That does happen. But often it doesn't feel right for me as well. I mean, I'm sure there's been some opportunities that would have made good business sense that I've sort of said no to, either because it didn't quite feel right or I didn't quite get it instantly.
Mm-hmm.
Or there were other projects that were my own or that I'm working with Rosie on that I wanted to give priority to. But generally, you know, if I'm offered something that's obviously a good opportunity or something I haven't done before, when I was asked to do Waltzing Matilda, the band played Waltzing Matilda, I said yes to that straight away without knowing what the hell I was going to do with it, because it was such an important thing.
Yeah.
And I knew the song and I knew how important it was. And that was one of those rare books where I really couldn't mess around with it. You know, the lyrics were what they were, so that visually it's exactly what the lyrics say, really, yeah. Or my interpretation of it. I couldn't really mess with that too much. So it was quite a different project to work on.
So I was on your website earlier and I was actually counting the books that are on there, because you've got this wonderful page where the covers of all the books that you've worked on are there. And I got to 80, and this Ruben's not on there, so I'm assuming we're at 81.
Is that... No, there's probably another 4 or 5 that I haven't actually got around to put. I'm really slack with my website. I'm terrible. it's so time consuming.
Yeah.
It's like, and I need to put a bit more time into it. But it must be closer to 85 now, I think.
And you've worked with Jackie. Jackie or Rosie the most?
If you do the numbers, I've actually worked with Rosie the most. But it's just that the Diary of a Wombat stuff that just really took off. And I mean, nobody knew that it was going to happen like that. It just did, you know. And again, from the business side of it or from publisher's side of it, you know, there is this thing where, like, if something works, they want more of the same.
Mm.
And Jackie and I, it's not being trapped. I mean, it makes sense to do that. But there, both of us have other things that we want to do as well. And like Ruben was one of those things, and other books I'm doing with Rosie.
Jackie writes adult novels and a whole lot of other things
exactly.
as well.
Yeah.
The thing that a publisher can do when an author and illustrator said, well, no, we're finished with that, is they can release the board book, and they can release the commemorative edition, they can release, you know, there's a whole range of things they can do to get it. Because I was looking at the Diary of Wombat series on our site, and there are so many different
variations,
versions of it that you can actually pick up for each need that you have. For a bookseller, I like it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's the thing, it becomes a big business. I remember when I first approached HarperCollins, which is 1992, when my first book came out, Ugliest Dog in the World. I remember at that time, I was sort of told when we were talking, because I knew nothing about picture books. I was totally naive.
What were you doing before?
Advertising. Right. I worked as an art director and freelance illustrator for the advertising industry. And in discussion, it was sort of mentioned that, okay, you know, if you've got, in 1992, HarperCollins was just getting to the end of that phase where if they had a manuscript they believed should be published, they'll publish it, whether it's going to be a financial success or not, because that book over there will pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
But soon after that, it's like every book has got to make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
And that just puts enormous pressure on authors and illustrators, as well as the publishers.
Yeah. Well, it paid off for them.
Yeah.
We'll take a risk on this Bruce guy, see what he's got.
But it's very hit and miss. I mean, there's some beautiful books out there that, you know, I think the illustrations are just fantastic that other people have done, and they haven't worked.
I'm the chief buyer here at Booktopia, and I get sold in thousands of books every month, and there are so many that I fall in love with that the public just doesn't see or doesn't know about and doesn't pick up, and I just, you know, I can't spend all my time wiping my eyes and tears, but it is, I mean, as a lover of these things, to see things that are passion projects or people working on for years and it hasn't really hit the market, and it's really just the market saying, or either not seeing it or there's nothing wrong with the book.
And it's very hit and miss. You really can't design it. You know, I mean, I think there have only been two books where, like, I use more my advertising background in that, you know, in advertising you might get a brief for an ad that you've got to do, and you've got, like, 24 hours, you know, by the morning you've got to have, you know, a TV commercial, a couple of press ads and all the rest of it. And there's only two books where I've sat down and I've decided by the end of the day I'm going to have a new picture book. And I've done that twice. And they are the first books to get remaindered because they haven't got any soul in it.
Yeah.
You know, it hasn't come from that place.
Now let's talk about soul, because Ruben has soul.
Right.
This is a book that every single we were given a couple of pages when they sold this book into us, and the three of us in the meeting just went, holy moly, what is this? And then the next time they came, they actually had a copy for us to have a look at, and all of us were just. Passing it between us, just going, this is amazing. This is absolutely amazing. And I've placed it in a prominent position within our offices here. And the number of people go past, pick that thing up, and flick through it, just going, wow, this is, and it must be just to have it finally after 10 years and 6 years of drawing, putting these things together, to have the opportunity to meet people who've sharing your love of this this book. It must be great, because it's a lot of work to put into a remainder book, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, it's only been out a couple of weeks, so it's early days yet. I mean, I've been aware that, you know, it's been getting some really nice reviews, which is wonderful and very generous of people. But it's a 96-page picture book. Originally, it wasn't going to have any text until I was asked to write a bit of a backstory for the main character, and then I found I could write things that were so abstract in nature that I couldn't illustrate them. Mm-hmm. So therefore, it had some text. But it was, like I said, it came out of this period of self-doubt, really. Mm. And I decided I had to do something where I had to be the best I could be. And this illustration style is actually the way I draw naturally. And I hadn't really used it in a picture book before. And so I wanted the illustration to be the best I could be. Mm-hmm. And I've been fortunate to have Scholastic backing me with this and just giving me the time to finish it. You know, we ignored the deadline that I had mm-hmm. for it, and they just said, give it to us when it's ready. And they've been terrific. And I've got to thank the designer there, Nick, because she did such a fantastic job on the cover. And also, I wanted a book that could sit alongside Arrival by Sean Tan.
Yeah.
And also... is it The Inventions of Hugo Cabret by
Brian Selznick? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They were the sort of two books that I'd been admiring at the time.
Yeah.
And I wanted a book that could sit, not to compete with it, not to compare with it, but just one that could come. And Nick did such a fantastic design with the cover. Yeah. I feel really happy.
They're the two things that came in our minds when we were talking about it. We're going, this is like, this is fantastic. Because there's a that reality that is just tipped on its edge, because you've created this world in your head and then used an extraordinary technique, which I'd love you to tell me about, because I'm not au fait with all this stuff, but it works. Tell me how you actually managed to get this world that you've created on the page in such detail.
Well, all the illustrations are done just with a 0.5 push pencil, lead pencil, graphite pencil. So all the illustrations are just done on paper. But this city, Block City, where our character Ruben has to survive, I wanted it to be different than anything else out there. And I was obviously influenced by, you know, whether it be bombed out Beirut or Berlin, mm-hmm. or, you know, sort of science fiction films of the past and things like that. But I needed it to be unique. So I decided I'd have to build the whole city.
Yeah.
So there's a software program called Cinema 4D, which they use a lot in films and special effects. So I built the whole city in virtual 3D, including the robotic characters that are in there, including the trains, the machines. I built everything that wasn't organic in 3D.
But I'm assuming that you... I mean, I've seen people get programs and I can't make head nor tail of them. You have to teach yourself this program, right?
Yeah, the learning curve was ridiculous.
It's insane. I mean, people...
Yeah, well...
you're probably now qualified to actually go and make a movie somewhere.
But the modelling side of it, I really enjoyed. It did take me a long time to work it out. So in many ways, I've illustrated the book twice or three times. But what it enabled me to do was basically build these sets that were like theatre sets, that I could light like a theatre set and have special effects with the lights and things like that. But then I could move through the streets with a camera like you would on a film set. Mm-hmm. So I could get continuity, and I could get my main character, you know, coming out of something on one part of the street, and I could lift the camera up above the street and take another still shot, if you like, when then the continuities can be right. And I could also create all these shadows that I couldn't have made up. Yeah. It would be impossible to make them up. And so by having those like that and then drawing them as realistically as possible, that city is believable.
It is so believable. That's the amazing thing. It's that you know, everything lines up. It's all exactly as you'd expect it to be. And yet it's imagined, like it's just gorgeous. Tell us a little about the story that you had as you were thinking about this. What was going on with Ruben? What's the deal here?
Well, like I said, the starting point was the character itself, and I created a character that I wanted to be a bit different. So, you know, when you look at the way his body is formed, he's actually got really tiny legs and things like that. Not that you necessarily notice that at first, but his proportions are a little bit different. And then I had that character, and I had this last line, which actually came from an old blues song that I heard on the radio. And so the last line is, "Once upon a time, Ruben caught a train." And that's the end of the book. Mm. And I liked that idea that the end was the beginning.
Yeah.
And then it was a matter of finding what went in between. So then it was a very slow process. And I had this city in mind, which then I started to build up. And the city is actually based on a lot of pictures of rusty factories and rusty machinery that might be small in size, but I blew them up as big buildings. Mm-hmm. I used that shape and texture as big buildings. And there are also sort of three robotic characters there as well that we get glimpses of. And they kind of represent what I think is perhaps happening to our world in a way, in that, you know, it's touching on pollution, it's touching on climate change, it's touching on greed and things like that. And our blinkeredness to some of that sort of thing. So those things are in there in an obscure kind of way. And then I found that you can't help but put some of your own personality or your own personal experiences in there. So there are a few instances in there that are actually relate to my family or relate to things that I like. And you know, like he's a collector. Ruben is a collector. He collects things that.
Well, that first scene in his little room, all that stuff that he's got in his little space, his little safe space.
Yeah.
Bits and pieces, photos, knickknacks, weird things. Just collected like a bird collects stuff.
Well, it starts off, the first line of the book is Reuben working in his safe place. Mm. And it's basically like a cardboard shelter made in the street. That's where he lives, and it's safe and it's hidden. And around him, I like the idea of him finding really obscure things that he maybe uses in a slightly different way. So you've got to look really closely to sort of find some of this stuff. But I like that idea of reusing old things and sort of seeing them in a lot of different ways. And it enabled me to put in some of my personal bits and pieces in the background, things that I've collected as well, that's there. And it's really hit me more recently how nostalgia plays an important part, probably in a creator's mind. Mm-hmm. But also how, children who you know, we all have our favourite children's book. And so to be part of somebody's nostalgia is fantastic.
Yeah.
But I try to fill that space full of nostalgia for him, and nostalgia that he could then learn from and create from. And that's how he discovers the world, and that he finds pictures, he finds scraps, and that's how he sort of learns what's happening.
Well, I get the impression, I mean, you're talking about people having nostalgia for these sort of things, but if, you know, a modern day kid looking at this, one thing that I felt with this book is it wasn't closed, so that the imagination can wander out any of those passages and keep wandering with it. And even the story itself, it doesn't necessarily have a beginning, middle and end. It's open the whole way through. And so kids will look at those pictures, and whether they're reading the words or not, they've got a story going on. And it will change, I think, over time with them as they pick up more in it, or they see what you may have intended. First, they might not even have any idea of your intention, and slowly as they get older, pick up the author's intention.
Yeah.
But those images are so so unique for me in my mind, and it just would just spark stories. And there's so much lying there, just like a Bob Dylan song in a sense,
right.
Where there's just so many great lines, and he just gives to us free, and they wander off in different directions. And could be another song if anyone was smart enough to pick it up. And you've got these little bits in this book that are like that. They're like little stories that any kid can pick up and make their own.
Well, I've always been amazed how kids can do that. You know, how they will sort of translate what you've done in a totally different way than what you'd intended.
Yeah.
And that's why I like putting in all this detail, so that kids can actually take it off in direction.
Yeah.
And nobody's right or wrong the way the story is.
Yeah.
And, I'm sure, a lot of kids are going to bring something to this book that I either didn't intend or will surprise me. And so I quite like that, you know. And I'm hoping that Reuben's sort of... inspires other kids to sort of be inventive and to look at their world a little bit more more carefully and see what direction they can go and what options there might be.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier the trains, and you mentioned that there's some sort of heritage going on here. So this is a story within a story.
Yeah. I guess again, you know, most authors, illustrators probably put a lot of themselves into it. And there's this one piece. Trains play quite an important part in Reuben. In that these trains, these huge tri-trains, which is basically three-story trains that come into the city, and they bring fuel for the city, whether it be food, things to burn, whatever, but they leave empty because the city has nothing to offer. That's the only way of escaping, basically, is these trains and these huge viaducts. And there's a sub-story there that we don't actually see in real time, but it's happened to Reuben previously, that he falls down between, he tries to climb up onto one of the trains, and he slips between two of the train trucks and nearly gets caught when the bumper's sort of closed. Well, that whole story is actually based on a family story. My grandfather I don't remember him. He died before I was about five. I don't really remember him. But I've got pictures of him. My mum often talks about him. And he had no right arm. And he was actually quite a mean, nasty, sort of spiteful guy. And a bit of a drunkard. But when he was about 10 or 11, he actually lost his right arm by... My parents came from Wales, from South Wales. And at the time, they lived in the valleys where the trains sort of fed the coal mines. And my grandfather was jumping, as a 10, 12-year-old, was jumping on these trains to throw coal off, to fill sacks up, to use as fuel. Mm-hmm. And he was doing this, and he jumped off in between two of the train trucks, and he got his sleeve caught on one of those big steel bumpers. The train stopped and squashed his right arm. Mm-hmm. So as a young kid, he had to have his right arm amputated. And like I said, he grew up to be a bit of a drunkard and a real sort of nasty piece of work. When my mum had me, she was very sick. And she had fevers and all kinds of things, and it was a matter of get the baby out and save the mother. And I was a forceps delivery, and they pulled me out by my right shoulder, and they actually ripped all the nerve ends in my right shoulder. My mum was told that my right arm would never grow, it would wither and be useless. Anyway, she refused to believe it, and for the first 2.5-3 years of my life, she massaged my shoulder, and my arm would just be limp by my side, and she'd put a spoon in my hand, and it would just drop to the floor. When I was about 2.5, she did that, and my fingers closed around the spoon. So she took me back down to the docks and said, "See, you were wrong." And then she would make me eat with that arm. Mm-hmm. You know, even if I had to use my left hand to hold my arm up, she made me use it. And when I asked her why she did that, it was really, I mean, she said that that's what mothers do, but it was more than that. And I think it was because of her father.
Yeah.
Anyway, I extended this story into a PhD that I was doing, that I started in 2005 and finished in 2008 or so. And I was halfway through my PhD, and I was looking at this relationship of left-hand, right-handedness and using the imagery of my grandfather and myself. My mum sent me a picture of my grandfather's father, my great-grandfather, and he lost both his arms in the same place when he was in his mid-20s.
And he worked
in the coal mines, and he got drunk one night and fell asleep on the railway line.
As you do.
As you do. And the first train took off large portions of both his arms.
Oh, God.
So there was this generation thing. And like, I never let my son catch a train, you know.
Yeah, no.
But so I've sort of managed to fit that story in there.
It's almost like thinking that it's kind of a voodoo or a family curse, and you're kind of using this magic that you have, this creative magic, to convince the gods that it's over.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, in some ways, my mum sort of fixed that up by massaging my arm, and I had the use of it.
You're putting it to bed by Reuben not getting hurt.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But that whole nostalgia, I mean, it's part of. I mean, I grew up as a kid in the sort of late 50s and early 60s, and yeah, so black and white TV, where the goodies wore white hats and the baddies wore black hats. And there's a certain nostalgia to the feel of those TV programs. And I guess I use that a fair bit in myself, probably more so in Reuben than anything else.
Well, there's a shot of Reuben coming out of the dark. I showed my wife the book, and she stopped on that page and went, "Holy moly, yeah. It's just such a gorgeous image, but the black is so black."
Yeah.
And it reminded me, my idea was that it was those black and white movies where they use light so well to great effect, and you've got it in that, right across the book, but that scene particularly.
Yeah, that's quite a strong image, that, actually.
Oh, wow.
It's funny how, and I've come across this in a few other books, some of the stronger images I've done, where we're actually seeing the back of the character as well.
Yeah.
I mean, on the cover of Reuben, it's Reuben going into the book, if you like.
Yeah.
And we just see the back of him. And it's probably one of the most powerful images I've created. We're not seeing the front of him at all, we're just seeing his back. But there's movement, and there's, you want to follow him,
I was on your website, and I saw some of the images of the before and after. So the some of the shots you've got from the 4D graphics
imaging, 4D,
and then your drawing of that. So you've taken a photo of your made up world, and then done a drawing. And then there's the photo of your daughter on the table, dressed as Reuben, about to get down or into a space. And it's lovely to be able to see those kind of shots. And I suggest that anyone who's interested in this sort of thing goes onto the website and has a look at those images to just sort of see how the process, how it actually came about. Your slight distortions, to actually look at those things as well. Very, very interesting. I mean, it's a really gorgeous book, but it has so much in it. And I think it's one of those books that people might just lie on coffee tables or lie in kids' bedrooms and find either adults or kids picking it up. It just won't go on the shelf. I just don't see it as a book that's going to be spying out on anyone's shelf. I think it has to be they'll lay it down and they'll pick it up whenever they feel
it. And hopefully each time they see it, they'll find something else in there.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is that some of those images just in, before you even get to the book, there's, like you open the hardcover, and then you've got these wonderful drawings that it's like we were actually talking about it earlier, so it's kind of like an Instagram post of different things he's collected.
Just in some ways that came about, originally the book was going to be 120 pages long, and I didn't really plan it out. It, you know, like normally you would have the text, you plan your pages to the text. It didn't work like that. So, like with an editing process where you'd actually edit out some of the text, we had to actually edit out some of the illustrations. Mm. So there were about 20 illustrations that didn't make it to the book because they stopped the pace or they slowed the pace or I now talked about it, so therefore I didn't have to show it. So we used a lot of those illustrations in the end papers.
Yeah.
So just to use some of them.
It's a great use. It's just divine. Bruce, thank you very much for coming in and talking about Reuben. I have to tell you all to get yourself a copy of this thing, to have a look at it, and to just marvel at the illustrations. It's just divine. Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you very much.
You can get hold of Reuben at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.